Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 314, an update on the European Union. This is being recorded on July 22nd of the year 2001. It's a follow-up to many discussions that we've had about the European Union. One does not hear a great deal about the EU in the mainstream American press, or even, frankly, in the so-called alternative press, and that's remarkable because the European Union is rapidly taking shape as an institution with not only global impact, but in many ways it's becoming an unprecedented historical event, with many of the most powerful countries in Europe already part of the EU and others poised to join, and we're going to be talking about prospective new members. There is a move afoot largely at the instigation of Germany to federalize the EU, in which the German-dominated EU would basically become one huge superstate. Research credit goes for the following article to a member of the listening audience who got this from the Guardian's website at www.guardian.co.uk/EU/story/, and then there's a bunch of other information as well. This is authored by John Hooper in Berlin and Patrick Wintour, Wintour, in London. It's datelined Monday, April 30th of the year 2001, and again, this is a Guardian article, and it's headlined by The Guardian, Alarm at Superstate Plan, subtitled Euroskeptics Attack Schroeder Version of a Federal Europe, and note the following. A blueprint drawn up by Germany's Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder putting forward a radical vision of a federal Europe last night elicited an appalled response from Euroskeptics. It envisages a superstate with its own unelected ministers, its own indirectly elected president, and a two-chamber parliament with full control over public spending. The plan creates a huge headache for Tony Blair and Robin Cook as the Prime Minister and his Foreign Secretary gear up for a general election. It will allow the Conservatives to claim that the government's friends in Europe are working on ideas which would make a mockery of national sovereignty. By a coincidence that elicited groans from Labour MPs, the German Chancellor's proposals are to be discussed by his party colleagues in Berlin next month, on the day Mr. Blair is due to visit the city for a meeting of the Party of European Socialists. Francis Maude, M-A-U-D-E, the shadow foreign secretary, said, quote, "We strongly disagree with Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, but at least he has the courage of his convictions. Tony Blair doesn't want to talk about his vision of the EU because he knows how out of touch Labour is on Europe with the mainstream majority of the British people," unquote. A report in today's edition of the news magazine Der Spiegel says that the draft envisages turning the unelected European Commission into a government with wide-ranging powers. It would be headed by a president chosen by one or both of the chambers in a remodeled European Parliament. The existing legislature would become the lower house. The Council of Ministers, the existing forum for national governments, would become an upper house. National governments would choose representatives to speak for them in the upper house, so that national leaders like the British Prime Minister and the French President would, in effect, become Eurosenators. The European Parliament as a whole would have full control, unquote, over the central government's spending. I would note that the European Parliament has a disproportionately large number of extreme right-wingers and overt fascists within its ranks, so please note the role of the European Parliament as basically the ultimate arbiter of the EU spending. Continuing. There was no immediate response from Downing Street, but proposals to make the Council of Ministers a second chamber clash with Mr. Blair's idea that national parliamentarians should form a second chamber and act as a brake on centralization. Mr. Blair has, however, supported the idea of developing the Council of Ministers and strengthening financial controls over the EU. France and Spain have both expressed deep reluctance to follow Germany down the road to a federal Europe, but the plan is likely to be given a warm reception at the Commission. And it holds out to Mr. Schroeder the tantalizing prospect of a place in history as the spiritual father of a united continent. Mr. Schroeder's plan for a superstate is contained in one of five policy papers being prepared for the conference in November of his Social Democratic Party, or SPD. The Chancellor took personal responsibility for the preparation of the paper that deals with Europe. We've dealt with the opposition to the federalized Europe, as it has been termed, in a number of different countries. I would note that even though France and Spain were deeply skeptical of the federal Europe, they basically have been brought into line. Spain was very skeptical about the idea of a federal Europe and of enlarging the EU because the fear on the part of the Spaniards was that Spain, which has some relatively poor areas, would not receive the EU funds, which are allocated in part to poor areas. And they, in particular, Spain was very, very skeptical not only of federalization, but of enlargement. However, Spain has ultimately reversed its position. That information was carried in the Financial Times of Wednesday, May 30th of the year 2001. This is an article by Leslie Crawford in Madrid and Hague Simonian in Berlin. Its headline, Spain backs down to Germany over aid. It reads in part as follows. Spain's government, led by Prime Minister José María Aznar, has backed down from a bruising dispute with Germany over Madrid's bid to link an agreement on European Union enlargement to guarantees on future regional aid. A foreign ministry spokeswoman in Madrid confirmed that Spain would now support Germany's proposal for a transitional 7-year limit on the free movement of workers from new member states at a meeting of EU ambassadors in Brussels today. Spain had previously blocked a deal on labor movement in a bid to secure a commitment that it would not lose out after enlargement in the distribution of funds to the EU's poorest regions. Mr. Aznar had been seeking a political declaration, unquote, from the Council of Ministers, the EU's top decision-making body, acknowledging the fact that one of the consequences of enlargement to the east would be the, quote, statistical illusion, unquote, of making Spain appear too wealthy to qualify for regional aid. The declaration, in turn, would have committed EU leaders to addressing Spain's concerns sometime before the current allocation of EU regional funds runs out in 2006. Spain is currently the largest recipient of EU development aid. At present, 10 of Spain's 17 regions receive EU structural funds because their per capita incomes are below 75% of the EU average. Between 2000 and 2006, the EU will have allocated more than 43 billion euros, or $37 billion, for their regional development. But after the first wave of enlargement, only two Spanish regions, Extremadura and Andalusia, would continue to qualify for EU aid. Spain thinks this is unfair. Skipping down, Spanish diplomats, however, say that Germany's irrational opposition, unquote, to a political declaration from the Council of Ministers had forced Mr. Aznar to drop the issue. So note here that Spanish diplomats say basically that Germany's, again, quoting directly, irrational opposition to the political declaration from the Council of Ministers forced the Spanish Prime Minister to drop his objections to this particular plan. Skipping down and resuming with the narrative, the German government reacted positively to the reports of the new Spanish position, although officials said they wanted to wait until seeing official confirmation today before commenting openly. So again, note that even though there was friction between Spain and Germany over this issue, ultimately, as has been the case both with regard to most issues in which other EU countries have differed with Germany, ultimately they have wound up backing down. And one wonders just exactly what sort of pressure was exerted behind the scenes. Time permitting, I'm going to be talking about the many tendrils of the CDU funding scandal that discussed in For the Record program number 276 and in number 278 has detailed some of the connections between a CDU funding scandal and numerous corporate and political interests throughout Europe, and a speculative line of inquiry discussed in that program basically presents my hypothesis that, in fact, the CDU funding scandal and the many interests that stand to be tarred, if there were full revelations in that, in part has been used as an element of political blackmail to hammer France back in line with regard to various areas of disagreement between France and Germany with regard to future EU policy. Time permitting, we're going to get to a discussion of Karlheinz Schreiber, one of the most important people in the very, very complex CDU funding scandal and some of his many connections, in addition to its impact in Europe, that, as we looked at in For the Record Program 313, could have considerable impact in Canada as well. One of the lines of speculative inquiry that I conducted in past discussion of the CDU funding scandal was the possibility that if, in fact, the French connection, so to speak, to the CDU funding scandal became fully revealed, that it could cause such embarrassment to the French political establishment that it might be that in order to prevent that, the French might try to bury many of the connections. I would note that Alfred Servin, one of the principal figures in the French connection to the CDU funding scandal, stopped over in Germany on his way back to France, where he was being extradited from the Philippines, and that caused considerable anxiety in Paris. One of the things that I wonder, and obviously I want to stress that this is entirely speculative, I wonder to what extent some of the French objections to EU enlargement and to the federalization of the EU were, shall we say, eclipsed by the potential damage that Mr. Servin's revelations could cause to the French political establishment and perhaps to some of the revelations concerning the continued control of the French economy behind the scenes by the what I call the underground Reich, the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization about which I've spoken so many times. Whatever the reason, the French have decided to mute some of their criticisms of EU enlargement and also of EU federalization. Information about that was carried in the Financial Times of Wednesday, June 13th of the year 2001. This is an article by Robert Graham and Hague Simonian in Freiburg. It's headlined, Paris and Berlin Agree on New EU Members. It reads in part as follows. The leaders of France and Germany yesterday agreed on a joint initiative to ensure Ireland's rejection of the Treaty of Nice would not alter the timetable for the enlargement of the European Union. The commitment was made in a special joint declaration at the 77th Franco-German Summit, just ahead of this week's meeting of EU leaders in Gothenburg. The declaration underlined the determination of French President Jacques Chirac and German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder to ensure their two countries push to keep up the momentum of the European agenda set out at last December's Nice summit. The two leaders are expected to draft a letter for sub-submission to the other 13 EU heads of government for discussion in Gothenburg. Quote, France and Germany, deeply committed to the success of the enlargement of the Union, confirmed their decision to continue the ratification process of the Nice Treaty according to the existing timetable and without any delay, unquote, the declaration said. President Chirac told a news conference, quote, We have confidence in the ability of the Union to surmount this obstacle, unquote. Chancellor Schroeder, for his part, insisted that the process of enlargement was, quote, irreversible. Unquote. And skipping down still further, at their meeting yesterday, the two sides studiously avoided discussion of German Federalist views to prepare Europe to accept up to 12 additional members and Premier Lionel Jospin's recent endorsement of a federation of nation-states. Putting aside their differences, they both found common cause in coordinating their views toward this week's visit to Europe by U.S. President George W. Bush, especially on the need to maintain the Kyoto Climate Treaty and to head off a confrontation over U.S. plans for a joint missile shield. In speculation about the George W. Bush administration, I have voiced my opinion that, in effect, it's little more than a front for the what I call the Underground Reich or the Bormann Organization. I think in some ways it's analogous to the America First movement prior to and during World War II, which strove for American neutrality. That was an admixture of a number of American reactionaries and isolationists who simply wished to keep America out of World War II, and also pro-Axis activists who sought to keep America out of World War II so that the Axis would win. I think a similar mixture of relatively ignorant American geopoliticians with an early 20th century view of the world and fascist activists on behalf of the Underground Reich is currently holding sway in Washington. And I would note the role of the Bush administration in helping to convince the French that they should put aside their profound differences with Germany over not only EU federalization, but in particular over enlargement. More, about the EU's agreement to enlarge. This once again from the Financial Times. And this is from the Financial Times of Monday, June 18th of the year 2001. This article is by Peter Norman in Gothenburg. It's headlined, European Union in Pledge on Enlargement, and it reads in part as follows. European leaders made the process of enlarging the 15-nation European Union, quote, irreversible, unquote, over the weekend by committing themselves to take in new members from southern and eastern Europe in about 3 years. At the end of their summit in the Swedish city of Gothenburg, which was overshadowed by violent riots, they also announced a strategy for ensuring that environmental concerns should be part of all EU policies. Göran Persson, the Swedish Prime Minister and summit host, said the EU had been able to, quote, speed up the momentum, unquote, of enlargement. The most advanced candidates would complete entry negotiations by the end of 2002 with the objective of participating in the 2004 European Parliament elections. Skipping down still further, the breakthrough on enlargement came during the summit's final session when Germany, which had resisted the idea of setting the end of 2002 as the date for completing negotiations, bowed to the will of a strong majority of EU states. The enlargement process is irreversible, the post-summit statement said. Germany basically did not want to have a timetable for these negotiations. They did ultimately accede to the will of other EU states. However, I would note that many of those states were opposed, as we've seen, to enlarging the EU to that extent. It is going to present a lot of problems because many of the prospective new member states, formerly members of the Soviet bloc or other Eastern European countries, are going to have a difficult time meeting a number of different requirements of European Union membership, particularly if they become part of the European Monetary Union. I would also note that many of those countries in Eastern Europe figure to be, in effect, client states of Germany, and therefore in the federalized system, basically sort of proxy votes for Germany in any potential disputes within the governance of the EU. One of the stories that we've covered for a number of years concerns the proposed plans, or at least the hope on the part of nationalist elements in Germany, to include the city of Kaliningrad, which the Germans call Königsberg, the former East Prussian, the former capital of East Prussia. The German nationalists have proposed the reincorporation of Königsberg, or Kaliningrad, as it is known. That was part of the former Soviet Union. It's part of Russia today. It's a relatively poor country, but the proposed German reoccupation of Kaliningrad has been something of a political hot potato with regard to the new Europe that's taken shape after the Cold War. One of the things that we've noted in past discussion of the proposed re-Germanization, so to speak, of Kaliningrad was that a prominent German fascist named Manfred Raeder, who had done time for a terror bombing in which several Vietnamese were killed, was actually hired to lecture to the German Officers Academy, basically the equivalent of the American West Point Academy, with regard to the proposed re-Germanization of Kaliningrad. In that program, For the Record, Program 86, it was also noted that the Bundeswehr, the German military, had given aid to Manfred Raeder's neo-Nazi organization in Germany. And again, that information is available in For the Record, Program number 86. That, in turn, is available from Spitfire. Research credit on the following article goes to a member of a listening audience who got this from the Daily Telegraph, specifically from the Electronic Telegraph. Their website is www.telegraph.co.uk/ET?AC, and then it goes on and on. This article is dateline Sunday, January 21st of the year 2001. The article is headlined, Germany in Secret Talks with Russia to Take Back Königsberg. And the article reads in part as follows. Germany has launched a secret initiative to acquire economic domination over the former East Prussian capital of Königsberg in return for waiving part of Moscow's £22 billion debts to Berlin. Russia's Baltic enclave was captured by the Red Army and renamed Kaliningrad in 1945. German officials confirmed last week that the idea of a trade deal with the European Union A proposal that would effectively return the territory to Berlin's sphere of influence was, quote, floated, unquote, during a private visit to Moscow earlier this month by Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder. It came as he discussed the contentious issue of Russia's debt to Germany with President Vladimir Putin. As part of a deal aimed at persuading Moscow to break the deadlock over repayments, Mr. Schroeder has agreed to provide German help in securing an, quote, association agreement, unquote, between the EU and the economically crippled enclave. Moscow has made it clear that its faltering economy means that it is in no position to repay all its debt to Berlin. Instead, it has offered Germany equity stakes in Russian companies, a development which, if fully implemented, could give Germany unprecedented influence over Russian economic policy. This last paragraph again, because it's an important one. Moscow has made it clear that its faltering economy means that it is in no position to repay all its debt to Berlin. Instead, it has offered Germany equity stakes in Russian companies, a development which, if fully implemented, could give Germany unprecedented influence over Russian economic policy. If realized, the proposals for Kaliningrad would make Germany the dominant economic player in its former Baltic stronghold, which until now had been considered irrevocably consigned to Russia. East Prussia, with its capital Königsberg, was captured by the Red Army in the spring of 1945. The area, which is about the size of Northern Ireland, is on the Baltic coast, bordered by Lithuania and Poland, and without direct access to Russia. Any suggestion publicly that Germany may be attempting to reclaim East Prussia continues to be politically and diplomatically taboo, particularly as Germany has officially declared 2001 Prussian Year and is involved in a comprehensive reappraisal of the former German state that was disbanded by the Second World War victors in 1946. Chancellor Schroeder has therefore passed on the idea of an association agreement for Kaliningrad. Chancellor Schroeder has therefore passed on the idea of an association agreement for Kaliningrad to the EU's current Swedish presidency. By the way, I would add that was as of January 21st of 2001. Now the rotating EU presidency is held by Belgium. Continuing. At a recent meeting in Hanover, he, Schroeder, suggested to the Swedish Prime Minister Göran Persson that Sweden, rather than Germany, promote the initiative. Sweden has already indicated that it wants to make Kaliningrad a priority during its presidency. Mr. Persson was last week reported to be giving a Schroeder initiative favorable consideration. Quote, the idea will be discussed at the next Russian-German summit in April and later at the EU-Russian summit in May, unquote, a German spokesman said last week. Skipping down still further, for Germans, Kaliningrad is still important from an emotional standpoint. German cash has been raised to reconstruct the ruined Königsberg Cathedral, and thousands of Germans make pilgrimages to the city each summer in an attempt to discover their lost roots. And again, as noted in For the Record program number 86, one of the people tabbed by the German government to lecture to its officer academy about the proposed re-Germanization of Kaliningrad was none other than convicted Nazi terrorist Manfred Raeder, whose Nazi organization had actually received financial help and some equipment, specifically some old trucks, from the Bundeswehr, the German military. It remains to be seen just what happens with regard to Kaliningrad. It'll be interesting to see that if in exchange for the... basically, it'd be interesting to see if part of this agreement, if in fact, as mentioned in this article, Germany has equity stakes in Russian companies, something that would, if fully implemented, would give Germany unprecedented economic influence over Russian policy. That would be very, very interesting indeed. As mentioned, and I've discussed the CDU funding scandal in a number of different programs, specifically For the Record program 194, For the Record 276, and in number 278. A speculative line of inquiry that I've engaged in connection with the CDU funding scandal concerns the possibility that the CDU funding scandal and some of the disclosures that potentially could come to light might in fact have proved so embarrassing to some political elements in Europe, specifically to the French, but the French political establishment, that in fact that might, and again this is speculative, that might be used as something of a diplomatic cudgel to oblige the French to overlook their differences with Germany with regard to not only the federalization of the EU, but also with regard to EU expansion. One of the people discussed in For the Record Program 194 and in number 278 was one of the central people in the CDU funding scandal, a master operator and right-wing mover and shaker named Karl-Heinz Schreiber, last name S-C-H-R-E-I-B-E-R. Schreiber is an individual who had very strong right-wing connections. He was explicitly compared in some of the texts that I accessed in For the Record Program 194 with Licio Gelli, the so-called puppet master and grand master of the now-defunct P2 Lodge in Italy. I say now-defunct. It would appear that its influence, or the influence of the P2 milieu, is perhaps greater than ever, with former P2 member Silvio Berlusconi now being prime minister and bringing overtly fascist elements into the Italian government, as he did briefly in his prime ministership of 1994. Schreiber was very close to, among others, Franz Josef Strauss, the Bavarian reactionary politician who was tabbed by many neo-Nazi elements in Germany as the new Führer of Germany. Strauss has been dead for a number of years. In For the Record Program 194 and in number 278, I noted the fact that Strauss enjoyed the support of the Circle of Friends. That was a group of industrialists who supported the Third Reich and helped to finance the operations of the SS. It survived into the post-war period in an initially underground fashion and morphed, I guess one could say, into some of the primary elements of the Bormann organization, about which I've spoken so many times and which is discussed in the in numerous broadcasts available from Spitfire. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience. This comes from the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation website. That's at cbc.ca/news. This is dated Monday, April 9th of the year 2001. Stateline Toronto headlined, "New book looks deep into Airbus affair." And this talks about some of the Canadian connections to Karl-Heinz Schreiber and the CDU funding scandal. The Airbus, by the way, is a commercial aircraft currently being manufactured by the EU. A book published Monday shed some new light on the mysterious man at the center of the so-called Airbus affair. The book details the complex financial dealings of Karl-Heinz Schreiber, the Canadian-German businessman accused of paying secret commissions in a series of big international business deals. Schreiber's alleged secret payments remain the subject of a multi-year investigation by the RCMP, and Schreiber himself remains in Canada fighting an extradition request from Germany. While the book, written by investigative journalists Stevie Cameron and Harvey Kashore, C-A-S-H-O-R-E, reveals much about Schreiber's secret money trail, some of the most crucial questions still remain unanswered. It was, of course, the RCMP's early attempt to learn more about Schreiber, and that infamous letter to Switzerland for his banking records that prompted former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney to sue the federal government, a suit which in turn prompted Ottawa to give Mulroney an apology. But for many years now, Schreiber's role as a middleman in international business deals, including the sale of Airbus jets to Air Canada, has provoked one overarching question. Where did the millions of dollars in secret commissions Schreiber received eventually wind up? The Last Amigo, written by journalist Cameron and CBC The Fifth Estate producer Kashore, is essentially an exercise in forensic accounting, painstakingly tracing the money trail at least as far as it can now go. The book portrays Schreiber as a schmoozy bon vivant with ready and easy access to Ottawa's top power brokers through the Mulroney years. It documents the payment of commissions to Schreiber on the Airbus deal along with several others, and the movement and disbursement of those millions of dollars to various Swiss bank accounts. From there, the money trail leads to a number of high-profile lobbyists and lawyers in Ottawa. In Germany, it's now known some of Schreiber's commissions wound up in the hands of German politicians, eventually touching off one of the worst political scandals in that country's history. What's still not known is whether any Canadian politicians received similar payments. Skipping down, speaking of Schreiber, he does give the book's authors a tantalizing quote, though, saying, "I could create the most horrible Watergate here in Canada when I want to, but I'm keeping my bullets for the opportune time." Unquote. This concludes For the Record Program 314, being recorded on July 22nd of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.